When you're teaching somebody web development skills, when is the right time to start teaching code quality and testing practices? Carl Stolle believes it's never too early. Let's hear how he incorporates code quality into his courses. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions. And that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. Welcome to Test and Code. I am pleased to have Carl Stolle on. Did I get that right?
You absolutely did.
Awesome. Well, welcome, Carl. We're going to talk about testing web stuff, like the front end and stuff like that. So,
right.
But before we get into that, who are you, Carl?
Professionally, for my day job, I am an associate professor of information technology and management at Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. I teach primarily intermediate and advanced undergraduate classes and students, and then a range of graduate level, primarily master's degree students as well. So I've been doing web stuff and teaching web development kinds of topics for longer than I'd care to count, but really it's been about 17, 18 years now since I was in graduate school. So I've taught a lot. I've seen my own teaching change in regard to the web, and sort of it's been within the last, 4 or 5 years or so that, our topic for today, talking about testing, where testing has really been something, even in the earliest intro classes, that I like to introduce students to.
So you said like the last few years, was testing just not taught on front end things, or was it just not really done on front end?
We've certainly had more tools available to us. And of course, one of the things that I think was the primary motivator for me is that for the longest time, if you wanted to do front end testing, you needed to use something like Selenium, which is a great tool, but it's also, a proprietary closed thing. And really it was when the W3C released the initial WebDriver specification, where now there's a standard API that browsers can, and to the large part, do now implement the WebDriver API so that you're able to programmatically access the browser. I mean, I think that's the thing that in traditional unit and function testing, you're just, all of your code is sitting. There is no client. There is no server. You've just got your code. You fire up your development environment or your test environment. You run your battery of tests, and that's it. It's the end of the day. But of course, when we're talking about web, you've got to test on the actual responses that are coming back from a server. And you need to generally feed those things through a browser so that, if you've got JavaScript involved or something, that you're actually testing the output of that in the way that a user is going to experience it, rather than just as a blob of code that kind of, benignly sits there on your hard drive.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said you're teaching this to people, to students.
Yeah. At
a college level, like when should people start learning about testing? Is it right away or after?
Yeah, well, that's where I've moved. To me, it used to be something that I would teach in my more advanced courses. So I teach an advanced sort of capstone class for our students who are specializing in web development. And that was the class where I had been, and this is, going back 3 or 4 years, like that's where I'd kind of been doing all the really serious heavy duty testing, both functional and unit testing on server-side code, and then some basic sort of front-end testing. And the students that were in those early classes that I taught really liked it, and they were also completely unprepared for it. I was asking them to make a bunch of different cognitive leaps. And so as I've, tried to work on more sort of curricular cohesion for the sake of our students, but also for the sake of my own self, so that I can say like, oh yeah, we covered this, or Professor so-and-so covered this, and then know to build on that. It became more and more obvious to me that we can actually introduce testing, or at least something, you know, code quality related that's automated early on in the learning process. And so one of the places that I begin in my basic web courses is just with linting, and sort of coupling that alongside, you know, their basic HTML and CSS validators, so that you get students, you know, even ones that are really, they love programming, they do all that, like testing is one of those things that it just doesn't get picked up in the sort of natural flow of things, the way that, oh, how do I construct a function, or how do I, you know, build a class definition? Like, those things seem to have, there's like an osmosis to them in ways that I don't think testing really has, because you have to be really intentional to introduce testing. So just even getting over that cognitive part that, hey, you can write code, or you can, you know, at least write a little configuration file that then go in and tests your code. It's sort of a big sort of moment for students to realize that.
I'm thinking about it right now. Things like linters and HTML validators and things, they might even be, I mean, more important than other code. So, like, for instance, in Python code, you can write bad code, and if it doesn't get run, it won't. It's okay. And like, there can be syntax errors, and as long as that file never gets picked up, it's not going to hit anything, which is bad. That's why we use coverage. But like in C and C++, the compiler itself is picky enough, and you can use warnings to where just getting it to compile is a big job. But in HTML and CSS, our browsers are notoriously permissive. They will let you drop off a closing tag or something, and try to interpret what you meant, and try to show things as you intended, or at least how they think you intended it. And that's actually, I think, probably not helpful for people learning code like HTML and mm-hmm. CSS. Because if you're just trying things out and showing it in a browser, you're like, oh, it looks fine. What's the problem?
No, you're absolutely right. There, you know, browsers are permissive, you know, to a fault. And I say fault, you know, very deliberately, that, you know, and making sure that students understand that, like, yes, like, let's talk a little bit for just a few minutes about, like, the origins of the web. Like, HTML was written not with the kind of precision of even like a parallel markup language with that, which like XML, where XML is very demanding and will not tolerate any errors. And HTML is kind of the complete opposite school. And of course, the idea is to make the web, you know, founded on languages that you didn't necessarily need a lot of technical skill in order to write. The trade-off there is that you don't need a lot of technical skill to write them. And so if you're going to talk about this, you know, in any kind of professional context or a classroom context, we expect higher than that. You should be doing more and better work than you could just sort of like stumble upon on your own, or file, you know, save as HTML from Microsoft Word or something awful like that. Yeah. So you're absolutely right that permissiveness sort of invites testing and invites bringing your own batteries of tools to the problem. Because like you say, you know, if you write something bad in CSS, the line just gets chucked. It's like it doesn't even exist. And you write something, okay, you know, I mean, you can push the most butchered looking should be HTML at a browser, and it will do something with it. And of course, part of what made the leap from HTML 4.01 to HTML 5, that specification ballooned by like 8 or 9 times. And the whole reason was that the spec suddenly covered error handling to try to make it so that browsers would uniformly handle broken HTML in uniform ways. So,
interesting.
Yeah, and then of course that becomes a very tough sell for students. Like, well, I just wrote this thing, it looks fine to me, it works fine for me. Which gets into another part, right? Where when you write for the web, you are giving up you're giving up having a certain compiler or a certain runtime environment. You're at the mercy of whatever wackadoo, you know, internet connected toaster or whatever is displaying your web page. And it's gotta work. Because if it doesn't work, it's not like a typical user is going to say, oh, well, this is clearly a limitation of my device or its operating system. It's like, no, look at this site is broken. It's broken for me. And of course, if you're building a site for somebody else.
I think you're joking, but it's probably not that far off. The store I walked by and I saw a refrigerator that has a news panel that you can watch the news on it and stuff. So I'm sure internet, you like toasters with this ability are not far off. But
right. No, like it's kind of a running joke, but it's not a joke. that there are these appliances, and of course, you know, the mind reels about software updates and things like that. But these devices are in the world, these, you know, browsers are out there, older devices and things like that. And
I want a text to tell me when my toast is ready. I mean, who doesn't?
Right.
After validators and linters, I assume you step it up and teach more testing tools. So where do you go from there?
From there, we tend to go to visual regression testing. So we use a framework in my class called Backstop, sometimes called Backstop.js. And it's a very sort of easy to grasp concept. What it does is it makes use of the WebDriver API and can run, I think it runs out of the box on Chrome. And you can even set it up to run headless Chrome. So it almost mimics like more of a traditional testing environment where you don't necessarily have browsers flashing up on the screen. But what it does is it allows you to set up a bunch of scenarios, which are like, hey, you know, here's a viewport that approximates like a mobile screen. It's 300 pixels wide by 700 tall. And here's sort of like a, you know, middling tablet size. And so you come up with different viewports, and then you give it a list of URLs that you wanted to test. And then all it does is go fire up headless Chrome and take screenshots of the different pages. And you can do either just the viewport itself, or you can actually do the whole giant like CVS receipt, you know, long page of the entire thing. And then you have to approve the images that come back from that. Of course, your initial test run, there is nothing to run it against. So you just say, yep, this is the way that the site is supposed to look like. Then on subsequent runs, as you're mucking about with your CSS or rewriting things in your HTML, it does a basic image diff from your sort of set of images that you've said, this is what it's supposed to look like versus what this latest render looked like. And the interface of it, it actually opens up a little report right in the browser for you. And then you can sort of, you can look just and see, you know, here's image A and here's the new one that we've got. It gives you little slider tools. So you can actually slide back and forth and kind of compare it. Mm-hmm. And it even tries to sort of highlight the visual differences. Again, we're talking about images here, so that, you know, there can be limitations to that, but they are faithful screenshots of what you've got. And so that's the basic process that it works. So it's really about like, what is the visual output of this thing going to look like in a browser? And the, you know, sort of point that I drive home to students is this is more for your comfort as a developer rather than to say, oh yeah, if somebody's looking at this on IE6 on, you know, Windows 98 or something like that, then it's going to look great. It's like, no, this is about you having your own internal consistency
right
with your design.
So I got a question before we talk about other things. So So if I'm using this, these screenshots, I'm hoping that like it's not just static stuff that I can have. Like, let's say I've got a shopping system, mm-hmm. I put a few things in the cart and then go look at my cart summary and then take a screenshot there. I can do snapshots at various times in a workflow.
Yeah, true? There's a sort of little DSL that's built into its configuration files that allow you to either wait for a certain amount of time, or you can wait until a particular element is visible on the page. If you've got some JavaScript that just runs automatically and makes, let's say, an AJAX call or something like that. And you could do, I hope that it gets to be more robust over time, but you can do some basic sort of interaction with elements where you can say, all right, let's trigger this warning message on a file input or something. So you can, you know, make it go into an error state so that you can grab a screenshot that's going to show, oh, this is what the form looks like when we've got an error message or something like that. And then again, sort of compare those things back and forth.
Okay. All right. And then how about end-to-end stuff with utilizing a backend as well?
Sure. So, I mean, even when we're talking about doing Backstop, like one of the other sort of things that I insist upon with students is that they're not just using, you know, file open in the browser and have some ugly file URL. Like, we run some kind of small little development grade web server locally so that students are actually interacting over HTTP with that. So, you know, even when we're talking about just like static HTML, CSS, and JS files, we're still serving them over HTTP, which is itself sort of an interesting testing problem, because browsers have locked down more and more what browser APIs are made available to you if you're not in at least an HTTP context. And it's getting to the point now when we talk about like the file system APIs or the traditional ones like audio and video APIs for accessing your camera and things like that. Even if you're running on localhost, you cannot reliably hit those things unless you're serving on HTTPS over localhost. So we have to do the secure context as well.
That's what I was curious about. If that's a thing that we have to, you have to do local HTTPS. Is that something you can do?
It is something you can do. It adds, of course, layers of complexity, including with testing. So when we're talking about doing, you know, more front-end testing or more interactively looking at, not in the visual regression testing case of like how the site looks, but how it behaves and how the content is presented there. So I've been teaching a framework called NightWatch.js for that, which actually within the last couple of months, I think was acquired by BrowserStack, which I think BrowserStack had run NightWatch. And if you don't know, or your listeners don't know, BrowserStack, it's one of the more long-lived multi-browser, multi-device testing services. So what they can do is actually emulate, okay, here's what your site looks like on Internet Explorer 8, or here's what your site looks like on Firefox 32 or something like that, or on different mobile devices and things like that. But they just acquired NightWatch, which had historically been sort of like an independent open source project. And it now looks like this is actually going to be a good thing because the company actually uses the product. And now, you know, the core development team works for BrowserStack. So that gives, you know,
so they get paid now. Future. That's a good thing.
Yeah, you actually get paid for writing software. It's this novel thing. But even in that case, it's a matter of, you know, we're going to run all these tests. And usually when our students get more advanced, they'll have like a suite of tests that are meant to run over, you know, their local, you know, local host or something like that. And then another suite of tests for when things get deployed to production, which is usually duplicated, but they're just hitting the actual live URL. Instead of the one that's happening over the local network. But you're doing legitimate requests. Thanks to the WebDriver API, you're able to sort of programmatically interact with the browser. NightWatch is a little bit different because it actually will open up a browser window where you can actually see it for, you know, a few seconds while it runs your tests. And then it you know, basically does the old school, like it releases an exit code, right? Like if all your tests pass, exit code 0, and if it's failed, then it's exit 1 or bigger. So
we still need those things for like CI systems. They depend on
And that's actually what I'm getting ready to talk about and teach this week is integrating these kinds of tests using Git hooks so that you are protecting, you know, at least your mainline development branch against bad commits by running these batteries of tests, you know, as part of that commit lifecycle.
So I know that this is, as a professional developer, I know all of this stuff is important. How are the students reacting to all learning these testing tools? Are they grateful for them, or do they feel like they're getting in the way of learning what they want to learn? Or
that's a good question. I think I've got a reputation for being like the kind of teacher who puts way too much stuff in any given class, and I'm okay with that. And I learn to treat students in ways that they're okay with it. You know, it's possible to say, oh, we can, you know, take just a slice of maybe a third of something and really go deep. But I think students and teachers alike tend to overestimate what can really get done in the span of 16 weeks or however long a semester is. That you're not going to become it doesn't matter what level you're at, if you're a PhD student or a brand new undergrad, you're not going to become an expert in a topic in 16 weeks, no matter how good the teacher is, no matter how skilled you are. And so as my career has advanced, I've been more interested in breadth than in depth because you're going to have, especially, you know, these are students who are going to be, you know, and do go on to be developers and cybersecurity experts and things like that. You've got your whole career to sort of like go deep on the topics that are going to be most relevant to you. But if somebody doesn't introduce you to the concept of testing until way late, or if they don't talk about, you know, how to write really good documentation or how to use Git hooks, then you can really go for a long time without even realizing those things exist, unless you're in a shop that deliberately uses those technologies. So to me, I'm always thinking about, you know, how do we use a class to expose students to a bunch of things to help them sort of work at a level of abstraction to say, okay, maybe I'm never going to write another NightWatch test beyond this class. Fine. But now I cannot pretend that I don't know that automated testing exists. I cannot pretend that it won't make my project better. And for some students, that means won't earn me a better grade because, hey, yeah. I've got passing tests. So my professors are going to load this thing up and see a bunch of errors in the JavaScript console or whatever. And so they begin to see that. And then the other part that I love about testing and the thing that becomes the real selling point for it with students, like, and this is a case where maybe I need to introduce this earlier, like in my, so I teach sort of like this two course sequence of web classes, and the fall is sort of like a class that's really just about like the fundamentals of language. We're not making websites to please anybody or that look visually beautiful. It's more like, can you write HTML and have it validate it and lint it out? Can you write JavaScript and have it not throw any uncaught errors? Like, that's the level we're working at. But we do CSS in there as well. And I teach responsive design and, you know, inclusive, accessible design. And one of the things that we do in that class is students, you know, begin their sort of early basic designs, and they're all in absolute units, like pixel units. So you're saying, oh, this is an 18 pixel paragraph, or this is a 37 pixel heading. Wow. And then we make the conversion of that into relative units. And, you know, it's simple algebra to go from like a pixel divided by another pixel and you get an M unit out of that. But students go to pieces in there. And of course, when you're talking about a style sheet that for the more ambitious students goes to several hundred lines and making all these calculations, and they're sitting there and they're constantly refreshing their browser window and like watching to see, did I do the conversion right? Because if I did it right, then nothing should shift around. Flash forward to the spring, they come in and I'm like, hey, this is Backstop.js. It'll take little photographs of your website. And then I'll show them. I'm like, here, this is all in pixels. Now let's do the unit conversion into rems. And then the tests pass. And they're like, why didn't you show us this last semester? Like, why you had us all sitting there, like clicking the refresh button to make sure that everything was okay. And I'm like, I know, sorry. There's only so much that you can teach in a single semester. And that's the interesting part for me about the visual regression testing is that, you know, a lot of times the work of refactoring CSS is usually not a whole lot of like what we would see as refactoring in other kinds of code. We're like, oh, we're simplifying this method, or oh, we're turning this into a helper and we got to test it. In yeah. CSS, it's usually like, where did I kind of go nuts when I was designing something? Where did I start writing what, you know, I usually call with students like magic CSS or desperation CSS, like where you're trying to get something to work. And so you throw everything at it. Oh, we'll say display block here and we'll throw in a whole bunch of stuff. Well, you want to go back and eventually clean that up. And yeah. So what I love about even just in my professional work about Backstop is that I can go through and be like, I don't think I need to put in this default property on Flexbox or whatever it is. And so I'll delete it and then rerun my test. Like, sure enough, that had no effect on anything that I was doing. And so that's been a useful tool this semester with my students to say like, hey, you know, let's go back and actually try to lighten this, you know, style sheet up. Because I do have students who are like, you know, they're big on performance or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah. Okay, we can do this JavaScript stuff, but maybe if you just lighten your CSS file a little bit, we don't have to worry about, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if, I mean, we've all been there of like the refreshing the browser to see if what you're trying to do is working or like, yeah, maybe, I wonder if that's important. You have to go through that.
Yeah, I think it's helpful. And I think the other thing, and this is why, you know, I kind of agree with you, like maybe that is the kind of like a rite of passage cruel thing that we do to beginners. But, you know, web browsers, and this is going to sound crazy, but web browsers are incredibly hostile web development environments because they all cache everything within an inch of its life. So if you don't know to open up your developer tools and to disable the caching, you're going to go and I do have students that like just get on our electronic discussion board and we'll just vent. They'll be like, I wrote this CSS style like 8 different ways, 10 different times. And it turns out it was, you know, the browser was showing me the CSS file that I wrote yesterday. Like it wasn't even loading up the latest thing, even on localhost, even on a local loopback, all of that. So,
yeah.
You know, being able to know those things and to understand how they impact you are important. But I don't know. We'll see. Maybe next fall I'll try to introduce some visual regression testing earlier.
Like you said, maybe not going so deep, but more broad. I think it's going to help them if they get into it. None of this stuff's going to be surprising when they get into a job interview then. If somebody ask about them, they can go, oh yeah, well, I've used Nightwatch and Backstop. And
yeah, and that's always the hard thing with any beginner, I think, is that they assume that, you know, oh, if I'm really good at this, I'll know this language backwards and forwards. Or if I'm really good at this, I'll know this tool backwards and forwards. It's like, the tool it's here right now, but give it 6 months, it might not be. And so then the question becomes, how are you able to sort of abstract what you're learning about this so that you can apply it elsewhere? And I would say, you know, before I get like, if, you know, any of my colleagues happen to listen to this and be like, you're going for breadth rather than depth. You know, I think the other side of that is that I go for breadth, but I'm always talking about learning, like not just like you should learn this thing because I'm teaching it to you, but like paying attention to how you learn things and what is going to be really useful. So yeah, like the version control thing, like one of the ways that I mean, that's the sort of three-legged stool that I like to teach on is testing, version control, and documentation. And you need all of those things sort of working in concert if you're going to develop a product, but also if you're going to develop as a developer, so that you can say, all right, I'm gonna learn this language, or I'm gonna learn this framework, or whatever it is, and be able to have sort of the confidence that, like, yeah, I don't know this right now, and there's a whole bunch of stuff I don't know, but here's the repository that I built while I was working through this book or this tutorial or whatever, and be able to then use the things you know about, like creating a branch in Git. Like, okay, you know, I'm following along in Brian's book and I'm going to just make a branch here to try out some things myself and see if I'm learning. And so, you know, I'm always preaching version control as a lot of things, but as a learning tool, it's just incomparable to be able to study what you've done and figure out what it is that you're learning and how it is that you learn, so that when you don't have a professor or a senior developer or a manager or somebody standing over you saying, hey, we're going to do this, that you actually know how to pick up and learn those things on your own.
Yeah, man. Wish I was learning web stuff from you. That sounds like pretty good classes. So,
yeah, it's fun because, you know, and there's only a small portion, especially in those earlier web classes, only a small portion of those students are actually specializing in web. We have an interesting curriculum that requires all students to take classes in web, partially because the second class is the one I'm teaching now, which is also about sort of HCI and user interfaces and things like that. Nice. Which I think is the other reason that I've really pushed more testing in there, is that these are, you know, students that are not going to do web stuff, but they are going to do other kinds of development. And so I want to make sure that when they go into those, you know, next level software development classes, you know, if they're learning Java or they're learning Python or whatever, or they're doing data science and they're doing Python, that they know that these kinds of tools exist, and that hopefully they at least feel guilty about not drawing upon them if they don't actually draw upon them.
Sometimes I think about that. Did I just write a book just to appease people's guilt over not testing their code? But anyway,
right. Well, I mean, that's the thing that I love about your book is that you do talk about testing in a way that I don't know how to phrase it without accidentally insulting you, but I think there's like a value apparentness in the way that you write and talk about testing. But sometimes it is useful to you know, explicitly say this is why this is a good thing to do. Yeah. And I think guilt is a powerful motivating force, especially professionally, where it's like, oh, I really ought to do that, but it, you know, takes too much time. And so, okay, well, maybe I'm a lost cause at my age and my stage in my career, but this, you know, 19 or 20 year old that's in my class, like I will, you know, preach the gospel of testing or whatever to them and make it a more natural part of development instead of like an optional thing that like this little group of hardcore testing nerds like to do or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, the industry's changing. So I think we're going to see one of the things I'm pushing off often is developers need to test and even front end people need to test. That wasn't always the case. Some big companies do have QA teams. I think a majority of the companies and the majority of developers out there are not going to have a QA team looking over their shoulder. They have to test their own stuff.
An interesting question too, is, you know, I think those are even in most shops, the border between QA team and automated testing can be a little fluctuated and fluid. You know, I had a student probably 10 years ago who went on to work as a Q&A or QA person, you know, and she was very much kind of like every time there was a deploy, sort of manually going and pushing all the buttons and make sure everything. She was almost like a backstop for their for their automated testing. Like, they, yes, they tested everything before they deployed, but then you're still like, what did we catch? What did we, you know, miss that came out on the other end?
Yeah.
But I think as you're able to do more things, like with front end testing, it's not that like, oh, good, we can fire the Q&A, or the, I don't know why I keep saying Q&A, QA team, yeah, we can fire them. It's more like what testing does for even beginning developers. It's like, this relieves you of so much cognitive load. Like, if you've got a linter that's enforcing a particular quotation mark style, yeah, and particular indentation, or making sure your tags, yeah, are closed or whatever, then you don't have to worry about that anymore. You've got a tool that's going to catch that. And I think the same thing is true for QA, is that we've already run this battery of tests that ensures these sort of low-level, knuckle-draggy kinds of things have been addressed. Now you as a QA person can go out and search of those edge cases or those weird combinations of browsers and time of day and phase of the moon or whatever it is that causes the site to break, that it ends up being a good value add across the entire organization.
And also just there's a lot of teams without QA. So,
right.
But the other, one of the things that drives me nuts is a lot of the, I think this is some old tutorials, but there's still a lot of people that'll say you need to learn testing practices. And at first it's going to slow you down. And I wish I could just slap them. Because it's a new thing. Anytime you learn anything new, it's going to take a while. Swap out for a different keyboard. It's going to slow you down a little bit. Of course it will. But if you embrace having testing as part of your development process, it doesn't, you're not doing it slower. You're doing it faster because you can, and with less stress, I think. But anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's a lot like saying like, oh, well, you know, stretching before you go for a run will slow you down. So what, you're going to skip that? Like, to me, it's much more in that category of thing. Like, are you taking care of your body before you actually push it to its, you know, some kind of limit?
I want to change gears a little bit. You mentioned that one of the things you like to teach people is just to, or get students to learn, is that learning is an ongoing thing. They need to enjoy learning and things. And you, speaking of learning, are writing a book on WebRTC, which is very new. I didn't even hear about it until I heard you were writing a book about it. Can we change? You okay with changing gears right now?
Yeah, sure. I love changing the subject and making wild shifts.
So this is through Pragmatic, also the same publisher that did the PyTest book. Let's just do a brief, like, what is it? What is WebRTC and why are you writing a book on it?
Sure. Well, so WebRTC is, if you expand the initialism, it's web real-time communication. This was a specification that had been in development at the W3C for a little over a decade, depending on how you talk about it. It's closely related. In fact, it's built upon the real-time communication specification, which is housed in bits and pieces with the IETF. So basically, it's a web browser API wrapper around RTC protocols, which lets you do things traditionally like, you know, VoIP calls and now we can do video streaming and things like that. So it's meant to be a peer-to-peer communication protocol. So if I wire up and write a WebRTC app, I can do basically, you know, in the classical case, I can do like basically something like a Zoom call where I can, you know, if we're connected over WebRTC, I can see you, I can hear you, we can send data, you know, arbitrarily back and forth. And you're doing it entirely with native browser APIs. So there's no plugins, there's no libraries, there's no anything. It's baked right into the browser. And of course, the way that I came to this thing was not that I was necessarily like a huge WebRTC enthusiast. I'm a web developer by trade, but I had an opportunity, and this was right in the heart of the pandemic. I think it was fall of 2020. There was this WebRTC class on the books at my institution, and it hadn't. And I asked somebody about like, do we teach this thing? And like, oh yeah, you know, so and so, you know, back when the Earth was still cooling, like taught that class, and then he left, and so nobody's touched it. I was like, well, I'm going to be teaching online. Students are going to be attending class from home. What better topic than to do this WebRTC thing? And I'm like, I don't really know that much about it. But I can pick this up. And so that was like in spring of 2020. I was going to be teaching it that fall. I'm like, well, there has to be tons of book. I mean, you know, the spec isn't finished yet. And so I started going to look for a book. And I was like, there's nothing here that is any newer than like 2013, 2014.
Okay.
Which of course is, you know, at least you're talking five generations of browsers since then.
Yeah.
So I cobbled together what I could to teach that. There was no book. Like, it was clear that, like, yes, I could buy a book so students feel good about spending money, but nothing that I read was all that helpful. And the spec had changed so much at that point, and browsers' implementations of it had changed, that it wasn't going to be useful for students to know anyway. So I taught the class, wrote a ton of code, gave myself a sort of, you know, shotgun kind of education in WebRTC over that summer so that I could come in and not be an incompetent in front of my class, and taught the class. It was great. It was super fun to actually teach that in a distance kind of model. Cause like when we get to like deploying WebRTC apps, I'm like, hey, who wants to come and join? And so like students like gave them the URL, and then suddenly, boom, here we all are in this, you know, application I'd been writing as a demo in class. And experiencing, like, you know, when you're talking about direct peer-to-peer, you have a lot of bandwidth you can work with, and you don't have to compress the heck out of a video signal the way that you would if you're using Google Meet or Zoom or whatever, so that you don't just run up a huge bandwidth bill. Instead, so, you burn through your own personal bandwidth instead.
Okay, so just, I know we're not, like, jumping deep into our WebRTC, but just to my own concept. So if I'm using normal, like a normal chat system or something like that, I'm going through the server and the server's relaying it to the other person. But with WebRTC, my message would just go directly from me to them, or is it bypassing the server?
Yeah, no, depending on how the network is set up. There are edge cases. So to set up a WebRTC call over the open internet requires a few additional pieces of technology, one of which is called a STUN server. And what STUN does is basically allow your browser to basically dial out and say, hey, can you tell me like where I am on the internet and what the, you know, port is I can be reached on this particular network connection. Assumingly, you don't have an overly restrictive corporate or military firewall. Most of the time you're able to establish that connection back and forth. But yeah, you're absolutely right. When that is the case, which it is for most home and office networks, then yeah, you're able to establish a connection directly between one browser and another without passing anything through a third-party server. And because of the way that the protocol was put together, it's all encrypted out of the box. You don't have to do anything special to make sure your audio signal or your video signal is encrypted at either end of that. So you've got full encryption, like all the modern stuff that you would expect. And again, you know, sometimes we have to make a fallback thing called a turn server where you're basically then going back to the, you know, relaying traffic. But most of the time you don't have to do that. You can make a direct peer-to-peer connection.
Okay. Now, is this, this is in beta right now, right?
No, it's done. Oh, the book is in beta. Yeah. Yeah. My book is, I think I'm in the third beta right now. So I've got 6 of the 9 chapters out, which are like the 6 bulk, like you can learn pretty much the core of WebRTC from that.
So it's not, your book's not done, but people can start learning it right away if they're curious about it.
Yeah,
so
that's right. And there's been a tremendous number of people who have bought, because there is no other book. I mean, that's the tail end of the story, is that like I finished teaching that class, it was great, and then I'm kind of like doing my end of the semester file and stuff away, and I'm looking at all this code and all this stuff that I wrote on WebRTC. I'm like, why am I putting this away? Like, there's no other resource that kind of covers all this stuff on the market, and especially the one that does it from a web development perspective. Like, to say, like, hey, web developers, this is another, you know, API that you can put into your arsenal. So it's exciting because there, you know, there aren't, this is the only book that's on the market that I'm aware of right now that covers the completed WebRTC specification. And it was a long time coming. Yeah. And I'd actually started writing the book proposal for Prague. And then as like an early Christmas present, I think it was in January of 2021 that they finalized and approved the W3C spec. So it was done, which to me was like, okay, this is green light, because now we don't have to write a book. And I'm not using the royal we, but with whatever press I partnered with, we're not publishing a book that
needs to be changed.
Have a whole bunch of like, hey, well, this might change, or, oh, this is what it looks like now. Yeah. Now it's like the spec's done. Yeah. And of course, there's going to be a new version and probably a second edition at some point down the road. But it is nice to have that confidence of a completed spec.
Well, good luck with the book and good luck with teaching. And I guess we'll keep in touch.
That sounds great, Brian. Thank you so much for having me, and great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Testing Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.